This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, I'm James Menendez. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Tuesday, the 25th of June. A fifth Conservative has been looked into by the Gambling Commission in relation to alleged bets on the date of the general election. We'll have the latest from Westminster and ask how voters are responding. Also, at least five people have been killed in Kenya during mass protests against the government's plans to raise taxes. The founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, has arrived on a remote US territory in the Pacific to plead guilty to a charge of espionage. And the legendary Irish broadcaster Micheál Ó Muirchertach has died at the age of 93 after a career spanning six decades. We'll have a tribute from the Irish comedian Dara O'Brien. There are just 9 days to go before the election. We're coming into the final stretch of the campaign, and there is one story that won't go away: politicians gambling. Tonight, a fifth Conservative, a member of the Welsh Parliament, says he's stepping back from the shadow cabinet there while the Gambling Commission investigates a bet he made over the timing of the election. And another odd twist: a Conservative cabinet minister who claimed to the BBC that he'd won more than £2,000 betting on a July election now says he didn't. And a candidate for Labour, now suspended by the party after it emerged that the Gambling Commission is investigating him for betting on the Tories to win his seat. More on all this in a moment, but first let's just rewind to earlier in the day when the story was simply this: an announcement from the Conservative Party that it was, after all, withdrawing support from its candidates Craig Williams and Laura Saunders for allegedly betting on the timing of the election. Two party staffers are already on leaves of absence. Well, on The World at One, Conservative Migration Minister Tom Persglove was asked why action had only been taken now.
Well, look, I'm as disappointed and angry as the Prime Minister is and various other Conservative spokesmen who've commented on this in recent days. These bets should not have been placed, and it is right that we've had this internal process, and that has, you know, those inquiries have led to the decision today to suspend these candidates.
And this was Labour's campaign coordinator Pat McFadden.
Well, the investigation must continue, but one of the candidates involved has admitted on camera to a gross error of judgment. It's taken Rishi Sunak the best part of 2 weeks to act on this. That is just weak leadership.
Well, Craig Williams posted this message on social media this afternoon.
I just want a quick message to the constituents of Montgomeryshire and Glyndŵr. I remain on the ballot paper on the 4th of July, and I hope to secure your support after years of delivery. I committed an error of judgment, not an offence, and I want to reiterate my apology directly to you.
And this is Kevin Craig, the now former candidate for Labour, suspended for betting on the Conservatives to win Central Suffolk and North Ipswich, the seat he was contesting.
I'm Kevin Craig, and it is the honour and the privilege of my life to be Labour's parliamentary candidate here in Central Suffolk and North Ipswich.
Well, let's go live to Westminster and talk to the BBC's Joe Pike. Hello, Joe. It is hard to keep up with all this. Tell us, first of all, about the Conservative Cabinet Minister, Alistair Jack, because I know you've been reporting on this. What did you find out? We'll try and re-establish contact with Joe in Westminster in just a moment. Well, what impact is all this having on the campaign? Here are some views from the people in Welshpool, which is in the constituency of Montgomery, where Craig Williams is now standing as an independent candidate.
I think it's terrible that they've made money out of that, that they've actually got the information and gone and bet on it. Not just once. One of them's done it several times.
Storming a teacup, personally.
Well, I think Sunak should have acted sooner to be stricter about the situation. I think Craig Williams has been incredibly stupid for such a small amount of money, for any amount of money, but for a few hundred pounds. I mean, he's an idiot, basically. What can I say?
I think it's all blown out of proportion. Far more terrible things are being done in the House of Commons than this. I think, fine. We've all done things wrong, and there we are.
Let's go back to Westminster and talk to the BBC's Joe Pike, who I think now is on the line. Are you there, Joe?
I am, James.
Hi. It is, as I was saying, hard to keep up with all these twists and turns. You've been looking into that Conservative Cabinet Minister, Alistair Jack, I know, today. What did you find out?
Well, Alistair Jack is the Scottish Secretary. He's held that job under Boris Johnson, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. And just as he is standing down from Parliament, he's making headlines. A few weeks back, he told me that he'd won £2,100 betting on the date of the general election. He'd put various bets on, he said. When I confronted him about this last week, he said he'd been joking and pulling my leg. Today, he said said in a statement that he'd not breached any gambling commission rules and he'd never made any bets in May. May, of course, the month where Rishi Sunak made that surprise election announcement and the month we believe the gambling commission are focusing on. Asked, however, whether he had ever bet on the election date, Alistair Jack did not respond. This case, we should though say, James, is different from many of the others. This is not really, in Alistair Jack's case, a question of whether he's breached rules, rather a question of whether somebody who was in the cabinet, who was at the heart of government, who's at Rishi Sunak's top table, should be putting a bet on a decision which will ultimately be made by their boss.
More similar, the case of Russell George, the member of the Welsh Parliament. That's the most recent Conservative to say he's stepping aside. What happened?
Well, it's not entirely clear. Russell George, as you say, is a member of the Senedd who has said today that he will cooperate with the commission, doesn't want to go into too much details of his own case, but has stepped back from the shadow cabinet, the Conservative front bench in the Senedd while this investigation is ongoing. He is the fifth Conservative that we understand is being investigated by the Gambling Commission after the Westminster candidates, Craig Williams and Laura Saunders, a couple of Conservative staffers, and then Mr. George. There is, of course, a protection officer to one of Rishi Sunak's protection officers who was suspended from his job and has been arrested as part of a police investigation. But Russell George is one of five Conservatives whose behaviour is being looked at by the Gambling Commission, although that authority is not going into really details of confirming who they are looking at or indeed any other aspects of their investigation.
And all this has now spread to Labour, which has suspended one of its candidates, but in slightly different circumstances.
Very different circumstances for Kevin Craig, who is a sort of PR expert. He's an expert in crisis communications, and James, he had to sort of employ some of those skills today in responding to all of this. He put a bet, not on the election date, but he's admitted on the Conservatives winning in the seat he was standing, and has said he would if he'd won the bet and therefore not won the job, donated that money to charity. Labour argue that Keir Starmer's decision to suspend him as a candidate to withdraw their support is in marked difference to Rishi Sunak, who, yes, did withdraw support from Craig Williams and Laura Saunders today, but did that certainly for Mr. Williams almost 2 weeks after a story first came out about his alleged behaviour. But it does mean, though, any sort of nod towards that, James, that Labour don't have a sort of clean sweep here. This is not just a Conservative problem. It has spread to them, and therefore there may be questions for the Labour leader too in the next 24 hours.
Joe, thank you very much indeed. The BBC's Joe Pike joining us live from Westminster. Well, let's dig a little deeper into what voters are making of all this. We heard those views from a few voters in Montgomery, in Welshpool, the constituency of Montgomery. Let's talk to Luke Trill, UK Director of More in Common, a polling research organisation. Luke, welcome to the programme. Is this story cutting through with voters?
It absolutely is cutting through. In fact, earlier this week, we conducted some research into which sort of scandals and missteps had cut through during the campaign and what voters thought about them. And there were two that had cut through beyond any other. One was the Prime Minister's decision to leave the D-Day celebrations early. The second was this gambling scandal, which we found significant numbers of the public, well over two-thirds of the public, were aware of it and said that it made them think badly of the Conservative Party. And I think the reason that it's had such cut through and the reason that it's so damaging for the Conservatives is it reinforces that thing that we know voters are worried about, concerned about when it comes to politicians, that sense of there's one rule for them and another rule for us. So I think this is very bad news for the Conservative Party that it's continuing this close to an election. I also think there's a particular challenge for Rishi Sunak, because we know one of voters' concerns about the Prime Minister is that he's seen as not very strong. He can't stand up to his party. And I think taking so long to suspend those candidates will have reinforced some of those concerns.
Labour, as we've been hearing, have had to suspend a candidate too in slightly different circumstances. Do you think people will make that distinction?
I think it's unlikely people will make that distinction on the circumstances, simply because, you know, most people aren't paying as much attention to the ins and outs of politics as people in Westminster might be. I think what a lot of people will simply hear is that a Labour candidate has been involved too. And I think it might reinforce this sense of a pox on all your houses that we're hearing in focus groups right across the country at the moment. Where there might be a difference, however, is less in the details of what happened and in the fact that Keir Starmer took action so quickly. And I think if Keir Starmer can make that point, and if he can make it, you know, obviously there's the debate tomorrow when we expect this will be raised. If he can make it there, that might convince some voters, not all, that the Labour Party has acted differently on this.
I mean, in that case, will that reinforce that that tendency towards cynicism and apathy that you talk about? I mean, simply because it's a candidate who's effectively saying, look, I don't think I'm going to win this seat. I'm going to bet on the other lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that this whole scandal, you know, the idea of people trying to make money from the election date, who might have been in the know about it, people betting against their own chances. I think lots of the public just look at this and think, well, actually, you know, the worst thing is lots of them think, will say, I'm not surprised, because this is just what I thought about lots of politicians, that they're not in it for the right reasons and that they don't put us first. And, you know, I know we can say that, you know, people have always been cynical about politicians, that trust has never been particularly high. But I do think there is something worse at the moment. I do think in this election, talking to voters, it's not just apathy and cynicism, but a sort of sense of futility that our political class aren't up to the job. And whoever wins next week, I think, is going to have their work cut out trying to change that.
Luke, thank you very much indeed. Luke Trill, UK Director of More in Common, a polling research organisation. You can find a full list of candidates standing in that Montgomery constituency on the BBC website. And also, don't forget that we do want to reflect the election issues that matter to you on the programme. Do get in touch to tell us what you still want explained or indeed covered in more detail. There are, as I mentioned, only 9 days to go, but plenty of time. We particularly want to hear from you if you're one of the many undecided voters, so-called floating voters or don't knows. Are you any closer to deciding how you're going to vote? And if not, why? Perhaps no party has captured your imagination, or as Luke Trill was saying, you're just fed up with everyone. But do get in touch on text 84844. It's a 10 to 15p charge. WhatsApp 03700 100444 or good old email world.tonight@bbc.co.uk. Now, in the past hour or so, the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has arrived on a remote US territory in the Pacific. He's expected there to finalise his guilty plea leading to his release and then to return to his native Australia. We can talk now to our correspondent Shaima Khalil, who's on the island of Saipan. And Shaima, just remind us, why Saipan?
Crucially, because it's not continental USA, Julian Assange deeply distrusts the United States government, and he has refused to travel to the USA because he has no confidence of what might happen to him if he landed there. Remember, in the past, he had accused US government of trying to kill him, something that Washington has denied. I'm standing just outside the US District Court here in Saipan, and I must tell you, it is quite a contrasting image, if you will, from where he's just been travelling from, especially if you think about that cell, the prison cell in the UK, in Belmarsh Prison in London, where he's been released, hopped on a plane to Bangkok, and now he's landed here. This is lush green, hot and humid, and this courthouse where he's due to finalise his guilty plea overlooks a beautiful beach. This is where the final chapter of this saga, this long and bitter standoff between the US and Julian Assange, will play out logistically as well. This is very close to Australia, where he's due to go after the hearing, after pleading guilty for that one felony. It is an unusual and a unique location to end a very dramatic case.
Sharma, it does sound quite surreal. Do we know exactly what's going to happen next? I mean, is it going to be a fairly simple procedure over in just, what, an hour or two?
Do you know what? Details are quite scarce. I was looking at the website of the U.S. District Court this morning, and on their schedule, they had, I think it was one of the first cases, 0900, 9 a.m. local time, the USA versus Julian Assange. It didn't tell you how long it was going to last, but essentially, from what we know, and we don't know many details, they've been very tight-lipped, those close to the case, but we know that this is the formality to essentially finish off officially the deal that's already been agreed between Julian Assange and the US government. And essentially what he's expected to do is plead guilty for that one felony, which is illegally obtaining and disclosing national security material. No jail time, because according to the deal, he's going to get credit for jail time served in the UK. How long it will last will depend on how long the back and forth is, but essentially what you're looking at is a judge to sign off on that piece of paper to officially announce him a free man.
Shaima, thank you very much indeed. Shaima Khalil joining us from Saipan, where the time, just looking it up, is 7:23 in the morning. So if Shaima is right, that case should get underway in just over an hour and a half. Coming up later on the programme, the comedian Dara O'Brien pays tribute to the legendary Irish sports commentator Micheál Ó Maoirse Chuig, who's died at the age of 93 after a career spanning six decades.
There is something about the joy in Irish sport of the local me being made glorious. And he was the poet of that. Pat Fox is on the field today. I bought a dog from his father last week. That is another one of his. He then went on to say, Pat Fox is taken free. He's missed it. The dog lost as well. So this sort of stuff, this very conversational, but very lyrical stuff that he had.
Wonderful stuff. More from Dara coming up in about 15 minutes. But we're going to head to Kenya now. After a day of violent clashes between the security forces and mainly young protesters opposed to the government's plans to put up taxes, those proposals contained in a new finance bill went before Parliament in the capital, Nairobi, today, prompting some of the demonstrators to break into the building, sending MPs fleeing down a tunnel, and setting part of the complex on fire. Well, out on the streets, police responded with force, using live rounds and tear gas. Well, at least five people have been killed. Among the protesters today in Nairobi was the British-Kenyan activist Ona Obama. She's the half-sister of the former American president Barack Obama, and she runs a foundation for disadvantaged youth and children called Sotiku. She was tear-gassed earlier today.
My chest is a bit congested, my eyes hurt, I have a headache, but that's nothing compared to what the young people have experienced. I was a lot safer than many. Many of them were standing in front of those canisters of tear gas and were being sprayed with this pink liquid. I don't even know what it is. So what I experienced was nothing in comparison. So in other words, when you ask me how I feel, I can tell you I'm fine. I really am fine. I worry about the young people. I am fine.
The Kenyan President, William Ruto, has been speaking on TV this evening. The BBC's Barbara Platt-Usher is in Nairobi. She's been telling me what he had to say.
The president has essentially said that the protests were hijacked by what he called criminals and dangerous people, that they could not expect to go scot-free for having carried out treasonous events. This is the breaching of Parliament and the ransacking of parts of it that he is speaking about. He said that the young people who had raised the issue of the tax cuts had raised a pertinent conversation, and he still wanted to establish a framework for a conversation with them, but this had to be done within the rule of law, and this would be, the state would mobilize all its resources to make sure a situation of this nature would not occur again. So he came across as pretty tough about what happened at Parliament, and he has also deployed the military to help the police.
And just tell us a bit more about what did happen at Parliament, because there have been protests in previous days over these proposed tax rises. Why did things turn so violent today?
Well, there was a much, much bigger crowd today, although it was peaceful largely during the day. They did throw stones at police for a bit, but they had come with quite a determination to try to stop the passage of this tax bill. And they were determined, a core of them, to get to Parliament to make their point. And the security minister, the interior minister, had warned the day before expressly that they should not do that, that they were allowed to protest, but they should not try to do that. And so police had been deployed all along the way to Parliament to stop them from doing so. And so fairly early on, there was a lot of tear gas rounds fired to try to keep them at bay. But they kept proceeding forward. And finally, when they got to the Parliament, they essentially overwhelmed the police and surged through the barricade. And then police started to fire live rounds to stop them. And there we have a number of the protesters were killed and some of them were injured.
And why are the demonstrators so unhappy about these proposed tax rises? And I just wonder, are there other factors at play here as well?
Well, they got quite engaged with the whole idea of the tax bill on social media. So you had these TikTok influencers who were basically making explainers about what it was all about and how this was going to be taking money away on things that they needed. There's a cost of living crisis here, and there are already taxes. And so the taxes, which were quite high, actually, because the government is trying to raise money to lower its massive deficit, and it doesn't want to borrow more than it already has. So it was just seen as too much to pay when they are already struggling to make ends meet. I'll add, though, that the other part of it, which has really been gaining steam in the last couple of days, is accountability and how their taxes are spent. And so there's been a lot of talk in these online chat groups about corruption and about wastage, and about just saying that politicians, if they get the tax money, should be using it to actually benefit Kenyans. So it's a question of money being taken away through more taxes, but then how is that money spent?
So what happens next over this bill?
It looks as if it's going to be signed into law, because the third reading took place today. It was passed during these protests. In fact, some of the MPs were trapped in Parliament when the protesters stormed in and had to be evacuated. But it was passed. And the next step is that it goes to the president for signing on Thursday. That is the next step, that he's going to sign it, and or that he's supposed to sign it, and that the protesters have said on Thursday that they will come out again.
And that was the BBC's Barbara Platt-Usher in Nairobi. Jails in England and Wales could run out of space in a matter of days. That's the warning from the body that represents almost all prison governors, set out in an open letter to the leaders of the main political parties today. This is what Tom Wheatley, president of the Prison Governors Association, told Today.
We're now writing to the leaders of the main political parties to let them know, whoever wins the general election, that they're on notice to take action immediately to avoid putting the public at real risk. We've been trying to build our way out of this for a significant period of time and simply haven't kept pace with the demand for spaces. That's mostly driven by people who go to prison for longer. That increase in sentence length is what's driving the population growth. And successive governments have been very keen on sending people to prison for longer. We need to get to a position where we're building new prisons to replace an ageing prison estate.
The latest figures from the Ministry of Justice show that there are only 1,383 prison spaces out of a total of 88,778. In its letter, the PGA says that in order to reduce quickly what it calls chronic overcrowding, the next government should pass legislation to release all prisoners at the 40% mark of their sentence. Currently, some prisoners can be released up to 70 days early, but not those convicted of serious violent crimes, terrorism or sexual offences. I've been talking to Natasha Saunders, who was raped by her ex-husband. She now advises the Metropolitan Police on violence against women. What did she think of the proposal to allow prisoners out after serving 40% of their sentences?
I can understand the level of concern from the prison sector. As a domestic abuse survivor, the really worrying thing is the risk towards women and children who have been horrendously abused in a multitude of ways, knowing that their perpetrator is being released after two-fifths of the time that they thought they were safe for. And that's the scary factor for me.
And in fact, in their letter, the association says that this reduction, 40% reduction, and I'm quoting here, must be applied to all sentenced prisoners currently in custody and retrospectively. And it doesn't specify any exemptions to that.
I think that's really the main crux of this letter, is that no exemptions and retrospectively. So, for example, my ex-husband is in prison serving a 12 years custodial sentence for 3 counts of rape and 1 of sexual assault by penetration towards me. If we take that aside, he also attacked a child under the age of 14 in 1997 and got 200 hours community service for it. We also had women who came forward at my trial and they gave evidence in my favour to show that it was a character thing, and they described horrendous abuse perpetrated by my ex-husband. Now, the likelihood is that should he be released early, he's still going to be a danger to the public. He's still going to pose a risk to people. And if that's just one individual with that mindset and that type of predatory, reoccurring behaviour, how do we know that it's not going on in so many other cases too?
There have been in the past exceptions for early release, and I think that still stands for the most serious offenders, including those who've committed the most serious sexual offences. If there were to be exceptions in the future, could you accept that some prisoners may have to be released early to ease overcrowding? Is that something you can understand?
Prison should not be somewhere that we scoop up people, leave them to fester for their sentence, and then expect them to go back out into society and be able to function. People have ended up in prison for a multitude of reasons. I mean, I've had a hand in training over 16,000 Metropolitan Police officers now. And my understanding for frontline workers, including my work with the NHS and things, there are so many reasons that can lead somebody to committing an offence. And everybody is human. When people ask me, do I hate my ex-husband? Of course I don't hate him. In fact, I can't think of anything in the world worse than waking up and being him. But I do believe that everybody deserves help and everyone deserves support.
But do you believe that someone like your ex can be rehabilitated? Because he will have to be released at some point, won't he?
I think with the correct guidance, they are able to judge the people that can be rehabilitated. And there are people out there, even domestic abusers, even people who have been rapists. There are people who can take accountability and really show that they want to walk a path of a law-abiding person. Whether he's one of those people, I'm not in a position to say. I don't have the qualifications nor the training to be able to know. But I would like to at least feel comfortable knowing that he's not going to get out of prison just because too many people are in there.
Natasha Saunders. So, what can be done to fix prisons in England and Wales? Let's talk to Professor Ian Atchison, former prison governor and author of a book called Screwed, about his experiences of the prison service. He's also been an advisor to Michael Gove. Good evening.
Good evening, James.
What would you do to ease the immediate crisis with overcrowding?
Well, what I would do is inevitably what Keir Starmer is going to have to do on Friday week, when this ceases to be a stick to beat the Tories with, and is, as we've been told, on top of Sue Gray's list of crises that's going to affect the country. And he has no choice. He's facing the immutable physics of incarceration. For up to 30 years now, we've been locking up far too many people with far too few staff for any good that we can do them, victims or society. We've got to a point now which was predictable and foreseeable and is a shameful dereliction of governments over those last three decades, where we simply cannot build our way out of this crisis.
So what does that mean releasing more prisoners earlier?
Well, that means, in effect, that Alex Chalk, the outgoing Lord Chancellor, fairly inevitably, it seems, will be leaving a note on Shabana Mahmood's desk saying, sorry, there's no space, and emergency legislation that will is the only fail-safe we have now to get the numbers down in a system that's running red hot, that will effectively release people at the 40% part of their sentence. And, you know, there'll be a lot of victims out there. And, you know, I listened very carefully to the your previous interviewer, Natasha, but there'll be a lot of victims and members of the public out there who will be just baffled at the mismanagement of the criminal justice system that's brought it into such disrepute that the custodial part of the sentence that judges recommend people be sent away for in retribution for awful harm sometimes.
Oh, we're just
sufficient spaces to
Ian. Sorry, we were just losing the line a bit. I'll just ask you another question and see if it improves a little bit. Should it be a blanket release at the 40% mark, as the Prison Governors Association was suggesting in their letter, or will there need to be continued exceptions?
Well, there will have to be continued exceptions, but what people must understand now is that the emergency release provisions that exist right now mean that people who have been convicted of violent offences, and these will include, for example, offences related to domestic violence and stalking, are being released, and they're being released into a probation service, which is frankly on its knees anyway. So there is a great risk to the public. But, you know, faced with the fact, the prospect, rather, of being able governors locking out their prisons, and you've got people convicted to prison from the courts who are, I don't know, doing an endless circuit of the M25 in a prison van because there's no space for them. This will become, you know, a major issue that has to be solved immediately with fairly drastic action. What we have to do then, when we've stabilised the system, is realise that we're still running a prison system red hot, which is unable to rehabilitate anybody because it's awash with drugs and violence.
I was going to say, so in the medium to long term, while more space is being built, does there need to be much more of a debate about alternatives to prison?
There has to be a debate, but it cannot be an abstract debate. What there has to be is a foundation, first of all, of safety in prisons. The state is not in charge of many of the prisons that it purports to run at the moment. As I say, it's awash with violence, brutality against staff. We cannot recruit or retain prison staff. We certainly can't do rehabilitation in prisons that are gripped by organised crime running lethal drugs into the place, which completely destroys the idea of rehabilitation. So we must get safety back into prisons, as well as actually making prisons places for people who are violent, who are predatory, who must be locked up, and that would obviously include terrorists as well. So in effect, people that we're afraid of, and we've got to do something else with the nuisance people who are clogging up the system and making that rehabilitation virtually impossible with the people that we really do need to pay attention to and try Ian. To reduce their risk and dangerousness.
Ian, thank you very much indeed for joining us this evening. Professor Ian Atchison there. Now, some voices just come to embody a sport, don't they? John Motson for football, Murray Walker for Formula One, Harry Carpenter for boxing, Bill McLaren for rugby. Well, in Ireland, Micheál Ómhaire Thoibh was the voice of Gaelic sports, principally Gaelic football and hurling, and he's died at the age of 93. His was the longest commentating career in the world. He began all the way back in 1949, and he didn't retire until 2010. By then, his turns of phrase were legendary.
It's a goal for Kilkenny, 2.18 to Kilkenny and 2.11. Well, there's a streaker on the ground now. He must be a Kilkenny man because he's quite happy with the situation right now. He's on the 60-yard line, the play's on the other side of the field. Ball now on the 50-yard line, sent back inside, picked up again by James Ryle. James Ryle gets it out to the corner, sent down the field. If the streaker doesn't mind, should be going over his direction now. He sees that, he sees the danger. He's moving out the field now towards open territory in the far side. The field, and the ball goes out over the line. Hogan stands side.
Well, the Irish comedian Dara O'Brien grew up listening to those dulcet tones, and he explained to me how important Micheál Ómhaire Thoibh was to the people of Ireland.
Ireland has these sports, Gaelic and football and hurling, and they're sort of central both to, you know, whatever, to our identity, but also to our summer. They were the defining events. When all the seasons ended, these things reached their peak. And Micheál's voice rang out across the summer in Ireland. He was the poet of those games. He was the chronicler of them. He had a particularly lyricism about it, but also they're games that are constantly very exciting. The nature of the game is action all the way. And he was able to get to fever pitch and bring through the excitement. But it was basically that his was a constant companion to Irish people over the course of 61 seasons of our national games.
Yes, extraordinary. He started in 1948. It's amazing, isn't it?
It's remarkable. Did a test commentary on a sport he'd never seen before. He'd never seen a game of hurling. And he said he was lucky. He knew the name of one player, and this one player featured three times in a row, taking a shot, taking a penalty. He says he's commentated, "I've never seen a player be as important to a match," and he was the only person I knew. So thank God for that.
I read somewhere that you say the games were very exciting, and I'm sure you're right, but I guess there must have been some dull matches, but that he managed to make even a boring match interesting. Is that right?
Well, this is literally the comment made by the President of Ireland today, that there are instances of his commentary that are better remembered than the games themselves. And during the day in Ireland, there were quotes being passed around, comments he'd made about, there's a famous player called Sean O'Halby, about whom the incredibly famous line was, "His father is from Fermanagh, his mother is from Fiji, neither of them are hurling strongholds." That this is all off the cuff. This is said during a commentary. It was so popular that today, on the day of his death, the word Fiji was trending in Ireland on Twitter. That comment has become so synonymous with them.
You called him a poet. I mean, are there any favourite quotes that you have? I mean, I've been reading some of them and they're just fantastic. I just wonder whether any stick in your mind.
There's little ones. He said that there was something about the joy in Irish sport of the local me being made glorious. And he was the poet of that. Pat Fox is on the field today. "I bought a dog from his father last week." That is another one of his. He then went on to say that Pat Fox is taken free. He's missed it. The dog lost as well. So he was great for that. Pat Spillane passes the ball to Tom Spillane. There's a mixed Spillane on the field as well. "Fair play, Mrs. Spillane." This sort of stuff, this very conversational, but very lyrical stuff that he had, partly because he was raised through Irish as well. So he could slip instantly into doing the same thing through a second language.
I've just got to read you my favourite, which I'm sure is familiar, was Teddy McCarthy. This is obviously that I've read today, not from my previous knowledge of listening to him. But Teddy McCarthy, yeah, to Mick McCarthy, no relation. Mick McCarthy back to Teddy McCarthy, still no relation.
Still no relation, yeah. He was glorious. He was a joy. To say one word about him, it would be a phrase said originally by the Kerry man, as he was a Kerry man himself, and in the Irish language he would have understood, which was "Ní eicimid a léi de rís." We will never see his like again.
Dara O'Brien paying tribute there to Micheál O'Meara Hurtig. Before we go, quick look at tomorrow's front pages, many of them leading on those election betting controversies. The Guardian's front page headline reads, "Fifth Tory faces investigation as election betting scandal grows." The Times front page story says, "Labour man suspended for betting on election," referring to the suspended Labour candidate Kevin Craig, who placed a wager against himself. That is The World Tonight. I'm James Menendez. For now, from me and everyone on the programme, a very good night.